While I was at that larger firm, Fagery, I had a case where I was representing a guy exactly my age who was on death row. And his name was BJ, a black guy from Alabama. And no doubt in my mind that he was on death row because he was black.
And clear of the closing doors, please.
What up, son? What up? Grind and pivot, pivotal moments that changed everything. Louis Max here in Queens, New York. Today, I have the honor to welcome a former superstar distance runner before he became this shining star in United States politics. Yes, a guy whom I'll call a real mensch. He's in the house. Straight out of one of the great cities of the United States, Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm here. I'm stoked. He's here. Mayor Jacob Fry. Mayor, how are you?
Louis Max, I am honored to be here on Grind and Pivot. Thanks so much for having me. I am beyond pumped.
I'm so happy that you're here. And I'm glad that you picked out one of my favorite ties for you to wear today. On this beautiful May afternoon, I think.
That's right. Correct? That's absolutely right. Carolina blue.
Carolina blue. Not going to say, you know, I might be a Duke fan, but we're not going to say anything. Right. So you and your city have been at ground zero with the tragedy of George Floyd. What have you learned? Anything new about people's thoughts of empathy, compassion, and respect for, you know, common human decency? What's it like out there?
Well, anyone that hasn't learned a whole lot, both about themselves as well as about their community over this last year, is lying, or at least is not doing enough introspective work. You know, I have found over this last year that Minneapolis is an incredible, resilient community. It is a city of extraordinary and beautiful people. And simultaneously, it is a city that has its work cut out for it with respect to racial justice and healing. There's no disputing what happened. I mean, the courts have determined that George Floyd's murder was just that. It was murder. And since then, our city has been grappling with all of the areas where we have come up short. Whether that's economic issues or police reform, you know, all of the above. And my hope is that we are able to kind of channel all that anger and energy and pain into something productive here.
How's it going? Is it working? Have you taken baby steps? Do you take two steps forward, two steps back? What are the obstacles, if you could, you know, briefly discuss, because we're going to get into a couple of things. I'm not really going to get political with you. This is not what it's about. I want to promote the city in its best light. But, you know, what are those obstacles in a nutshell, if you could kind of briefly talk about it?
I mean, there are obstacles throughout. You know, it's not one policy or one reform. And, you know, I could get into a litany of the changes that we've made, but, you know, that's really not the subject matter here. I mean, look, it's racism. It's some of these structural and institutional issues that have plagued cities for generations at this point. It's having to recognize that, you know, there's not just one lever that you pull at City Hall and suddenly everything's better. And there's no magic wand that you can wave to suddenly correct all of these issues. It's got to be like this fully comprehensive approach, which is why I'm hoping that this moment, if anything, is recognized for its magnitude and that people are galvanized to make the true change that we need.
Fantastic. Well done. Well said. You know, a lot of people probably don't know a lot about you since you're not a native from Minneapolis.
Let's Minneapolitan, what they call it.
What do they call it?
It's called a Minneapolitan.
Okay.
Yeah, not as easy as a New Yorker, you know.
No, not as easy. Okay, Minneapolitan. I like it. Okay. Yeah. You know, you're from, and let's be fully transparent here as I speak to you for the first time, you know, in this kind of setting. Jacob happens to be my nephew, believe it or not. So he's part of my family. And right. I know for a fact that he was, brought up and born in Virginia on the East Coast. So let's go back to Virginia where you were. Let's skip ahead. And you were a star high school athlete, a runner, a distance runner. And if nobody knows that, they could check that out for sure. There's a lot of stuff written about it and documented. But were you involved in any other sports prior to getting into the heavy duty running?
Yeah, before I was a serious runner exclusively, as you know, Uncle Louie, I played both soccer and basketball. So it was kind of a combination of the two of those. And at some point, I always realized that my passion was going to be in running. And I know that was probably a little bit of a disappointment for you since you are, the AAU basketball coach extraordinaire. and I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but about my final basketball game that I ever played.
I didn't even know you actually played soccer. I definitely knew you were. Your brother could definitely play soccer. You've been on the courts. All right. You know what? Enlighten us.
I could shoot. I'll tell you what, I had a pretty sweet jump shot. You may not recognize it now, but my last basketball game, summer league, and I was playing for, Fairfax Police Youth Club at the time, kind of select basketball. And we were playing DeMatha. You know DeMatha?
Oh, DeMatha's heavy duty. Absolutely.
Yeah, very heavy duty.
Morgan Wooten. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Joseph Forte. I mean, this was a team. And so we were playing DeMatha's, what I believe was their freshman team at the time. But this was summer league. And before that, top guys on the freshman team got brought up to both JV and varsity. So, I don't know this to be the case, but I was told that Joe Forte, who ultimately played for UNC, was on this team at the time. And so I was already thinking, my basketball career is coming to an end. I think I'm better at this running thing. That's where my passion lies. But nonetheless, I was in the game and I was dribbling up the court and I go to fake left and pass right. And this kid with these huge, thick rec specs, remember rec specs?
Sure.
Yeah. So he intercepts the ball and takes off down the court. And I, of course, chase after him. He was about my size and I'm not all that tall. and I go up to block him. He dunks on me. I mean, dunks on me. This kid that couldn't have been more than 5'8". I don't know, 5'7". Wow. Yeah, yeah, dunked. And at that moment, I thought to myself, you know what? No matter how hard I train, no matter how hard I work, I will not be able to dunk the basketball like this kid just did. And I looked over at the coach and I say, yeah, coach, that's enough. Take me out.
I'm done.
That was the last play that I ever participated in for basketball. And from then on, it was all running all the time.
I love it.
As you recall.
I love it. Absolutely. So you were quite a runner. Did you know immediately that running was something that you were good at? Or was it something that came gradually? How did that work?
Well, I knew right away that I was good at it. I also knew right away that I had an aptitude for working my tail off, perhaps more than other people did. My talent was not that I was all that fluid or even necessarily all that fast, but that I was able and willing to work harder than the other people standing next to me on the starting line. And I thought that was a beautiful thing, this direct correlation between hard work and success. You knew me as a kid, I was crazy. The amount that I would put in and the effort that I would put into running was pretty ridiculous at times, but it also led to, I won the state championship and, got a scholarship to college and ran professionally. And it led to any success in that area that I had.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were quite successful and you were definitely passionate and dedicated by all means. The training, I remember there was a lot of training to do, correct? Did you have, how much coaching was involved? Was there a mentor or was there anybody along the lines that, was kind of guiding you at the early stages?
Yeah, I always had mentors along the way. Early on, it was this guy actually at camp up at Brant Lake. It was Uncle Merle Norcross, not my true uncle, but he was a track coach himself. And I think his whole purpose was to just make sure I was having fun with things, because I had the propensity to be a little bit too intense, even when I was 10 and 11. And then, you know, later I had a series of track coaches, both in high school and college and professionally. And yeah, they certainly guide you along the way, and it makes sense to listen to them, because otherwise you're just stuck in your own head.
Right. What was your major event, though? What was a major event? Was it a mile, or did it change to 10K? Refresh me on that.
Yeah. So in high school, it was the 2 mile. And so I won the state championship by a tenth of a second in high school in Virginia. In college, you move up. And so it was the 5,000 meters and the 10,000 meters, which is 6.5, 3.1 and 6.2 miles, respectively. And then professionally, I ultimately ran the marathon. In fact, my last marathon, as you know, was in your hood, was in New York City. I ran the Olympic trials there. And then my final race was the New York City Marathon the following year.
Right. Let's go back for a second. You got recruited. Did you go on any cool visits? You go to any schools that, Division I schools that kind of wined and dined, even though it was a track and field, because obviously not the basketball teams, you think the football obviously throw a lot of money at everybody. But do you have any good recollections about some of those visits?
Yeah, for those of them that I remember, I mean, these are the first time that I was, you know, engaged in any sort of party atmosphere, really. And
right.
Whether that was, William & Mary, obviously I had a great time there. That's where I ended up going. It was largely due to the coach and the team and the fact it was a good school. You know, I had a fabulous time at Tennessee. Those volunteers know how to throw a great party.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
And it was unreal. That was actually the year that they had just won the college football championship.
Oh, geez.
And so they were just coming off of the glory days there. Where else did I go? I went to Princeton, which was one of my kind of final two choices there. And obviously beautiful campus, amazing reputation, all that. And then I went to American.
I'm trying to think. In Washington, right? American in Washington.
Washington, D.C. there. Right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, it's kind of still in your backyard. So I guess you didn't drive down to Tennessee in that gold painted car you had, right?
Oh, God,
I think it was something to do with Steve Prefontaine, correct?
That was Prefontaine, yeah. Grandpa Jerry had a Chevrolet Beretta. Do you remember that thing?
Yeah, it was black originally, correct?
Yeah, it was originally black. I don't know that it was ever necessarily painted gold, but it was more rusting off, and the window wouldn't shut, and it was leaking all the time. And I think in order to actually have the ignition turn over, you had to like have the car moving. It was such a dump. And it required you to put oil in it every single time you added gas.
Sounds about right.
And if you didn't put oil in, I mean, the thing burns so hot. I think I just burned the whole engine out within like 2 years, a year and a half or something like that. And I had one of those vanity plates as well, which is pretty embarrassing, but it said pre-Fry. So like Prefontaine was like my idol.
He was your man right now.
At the time.
Tell us who Steve Prefontaine was, for people that don't know.
Yeah. So Prefontaine was this epic figure that was, he held all of these American records for distance running, but what made him really famous was his guts. He was this beautifully charismatic figure that people wanted to be around, and excited people and inspired people. And ultimately he died in a car crash at a very young age. So it's like that classic kind of only the good die young James Dean scenario. But right now, believe it or not, his poster and quote sits right above where Frida, our 8-month-old baby, sleeps. And so when we were transitioning the nursery, I was like, you know what, this is a good lesson to live by, which is some, you know, guts quote or something.
Yeah. I'm glad I did my homework. Excellent.
That's right.
But I do remember that. So you got close to the Olympics, in pretty close. What made you basically retire from, you know, competing running wise? Where did that pivotal moment come in that kind of changed your life? I know you went to law school at Villanova, so we know that. And then, so you went from basically Villanova Law School. How did you settle in Minneapolis, and what was that pivotal moment that kind of changed your life?
Well, my goal my entire running career was to represent Team USA. I wanted to be able to wear red, white, and blue, and there's a special tingle that you get when you're running for USA that you don't necessarily have if you're running for Nike or Saucony or Brooks. And I ran the Twin Cities Marathon, which was the US championship that year. And I qualified for the Pan American Games, which is like the Olympics for this half of the world.
Okay.
And I remember the day that they told me that I had qualified for the team. Arguably more importantly, I remember the day that I got this big ass box in the mail delivered to my parents' home in Oakton, Virginia. And I opened it up and there, along with all the other gear, was a USA jersey. I mean, I don't think I took the thing off for the next 3 weeks. I was so happy.
That was like one of the happiest
moments of my entire life. But you know, my goal was not just to compete for USA, it was to compete well. And oftentimes, you know, people in their running career, they'll get to the big race and then they blow it. They'll get to that most important one. And so what I'm proud of is the moments of my running career that mattered most. The two times that I ran for Team USA were also the two best runs of my entire life. Races or training or anything. I mean, I ran at the Pan American Games. I was ranked like, I don't know, last or third to last out of, you know, 30 some. I finished fourth, just out of the medals. And then I raced again for Team USA in the Austin Marathon, which was the international team challenge, and we beat Kenya and I won. And so after that, after I had ran for Team USA, competed successfully wearing the jersey, that's all I really wanted to do. And so the passion was very much gone. But additionally, I'll tell you, I didn't have as great of a shot at making the Olympic team. And I knew that. You know, I was ranked 10th in the country for the marathon. And in order to make the Olympics, you got to be top three. And the difference between me at 10th place and the fifth best runner was actually relatively substantial.
Sure.
And it wasn't something I knew at that point where I could like train my way in. I was already training harder than most of the other athletes. But it was a matter of just, you know, of talent.
The gift, talent. I mean, there's nothing.
Don't get me wrong. I had enough of a gift. I was the 10th best in the country.
Obviously.
I'm not complaining or anything, but like, right. but these, some of these guys that were coming up at the time that were younger than me. So, you know, distance runners peak is for men, you know, it's oftentimes around 30 years old or something. Now I stopped running when I was like 27 or 28 or somewhere in that range. So I arguably wasn't even at my peak yet, but still these guys that were younger than me, they were more talented. They had, you know, longer legs and more fluid strides and all the rest. They were kicking my butt.
Right.
And so the writing was very much on the wall at the same time. And that made it a little easier for me to transition to what was next, which was law. I was becoming a lawyer at the time. I got a job at a law firm out in Minneapolis and I moved out here and started my life.
So you get into politics. How did you get into politics? Let's first tackle that.
Yeah. So I always knew that I wanted to be involved in community work. I knew that I could pursue that community work in part through the law, which was my profession at the time.
Civil rights, correct?
Yeah. Well, I started off doing business litigation but while I was at that larger firm, Fagree, I had a case where I was representing a guy exactly my age who was on death row. And his name was BJ, a black guy from Alabama, and no doubt in my mind that he was on death row because he was black. And so I represented him and obviously got pretty passionate about that. There were a number of other issues that I started to get into as well. Marriage equality was a big one. We started a race that raised a whole bunch of money and got a lot of volunteer support for pushing for marriage equality and against this really hateful constitutional amendment that had come out at the time. I did some work on the north side of our city around some of the housing issues following a tornado, literally ripping through that area of our city. And I started to realize that my passion more and more was in public service. And you know, brought a team together. I ran against an incumbent for the third ward and won, and then championed a number of issues, most notably in the area of affordable housing, and ran for mayor. And won again, and you know the rest is history, I guess. But it's been a time and a lot of transitions in the meantime.
Absolutely. So you know, so you put forth your greatest strength, which was, you know, passion and dedication. to trying to help better communities and people. Did you have any idea what to expect as a politician? You know, listen, we could get into a little bit again about, you know, where you're at now and what's gone on the last year. But, you know, did you really have any expectation at all being, you know, what it was going to be like to be involved in politics and as legitimate, you know, politician?
I think I had a pretty good feel for how public service would be in 2018 and 2019.
Okay.
I don't think I had any idea
the
unprecedented nature of 2020. And if anybody tells you that they fully expected it, they are full of it.
Of course.
I mean, I don't think I said the word pandemic when I was running for election a single time. I don't think I had any idea that that pandemic would be lopped on top of numerous other difficulties and controversies and crises that have hit our city in this last year, from George Floyd's murder to the unrest that we experienced, to an economic downturn and a city budgetary crisis. There have been so many. And that scope and number of crises that were sandwiched on top of one another, no, I don't think anybody fully anticipated that. But, you know, you have to keep moving forward. And you keep putting one step in front of the other and you tell the truth and you try and do the right thing, which is oftentimes up for debate. And that's what you can do.
I want to kind of get a little deep into your psychic a little bit, because, you know, this past year, you know, you probably learned a ton, because people might be interested in hearing, you know, what, you know, Jacob Fry, the human, not Jacob Fry, the politician, because we know, you know, listen, that's a game everybody, you got to play. We know that's your job, but, you know, 10 o'clock at night, 10:30, 11, you know, you get up, you go to the refrigerator for a second, you take a drink out and you're staring out the window. You know, you're just thinking, what do you got? Give me something here.
Yeah.
Paint me a Picasso.
Paint you a picture of what it was like. Well, first I'll say that you have to keep reminding yourself, as difficult as it is, that it's not about you. You know, it's these 400 years worth of injustice. It's all these different systemic issues. But at the same time, as you pointed out, yeah, in many respects, I was at the center, and we continue collectively as a city to be at the center of this, like, 100 years in the making racial reckoning that we're experiencing right now. But since you asked about me specifically and how it was, look, man, it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. It was tough. It was painful. And, you know, I recognize that this last year, the pain has far more been acutely felt by our Black community. And so, again, I'll preface it. It ain't about me. But yeah, you know, Sarah was rock solid. She has a backbone of steel and was, you know, helping to pick me back up and put me together each night at, you know, 9:30, 10, whenever it is, so that you can get back up the next morning and keep trying to make progress in the city. You know, you also realize a lot more about yourself through these times. And, you know, you've known me since I was zero. You've known me as an awkward 9-year-old. You've known me as a relatively nutty teenager. And you probably also know that I usually operate with quite a bit of confidence, and you operate with this kind of almost aura or protection, which is the protection of other people having said, hey, you did this well. Hey, great. You did a good grade on that paper. You congratulations on winning that race. You're really tough. Way to go getting into that great school, whatever it is. And you develop kind of an armor of confidence that you feel that you can go into almost any situation and have the ability to get the job done. And, you know, that was kind of just a utter belief in yourself that is something that I've always had. And, you know, cocky, fine, confidence, whatever you want to call it. But especially through a circumstance like this, where there is so much coming at you from every single side, and the situation is so far beyond at times what one person or even a whole enterprise can handle, you know, that armor, it does get worn away. And you start to realize, what you start to do is just press everything else aside and you look at the issue that is before you and you just make several commitments to yourself. You say, okay, I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm going to tell the truth. No matter what, I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to try and do what's right. And oftentimes that's up for debate.
Correct.
And you're going to do everything possible to protect the city. And like literally other than those core and functional things, like a lot of the politics, the armor, the so much of the rest kind of goes out the window. But, you know, to answer your question, it was hard because, you know, I had a very pregnant wife who was studying for the bar exam at the time. We were, you know, on the verge of having our first child in September. We had people that were often protesting outside our home. And then simultaneously, you got to keep doing the work of a very important job that I love. Even in some of the darkest times, you still recognize the need for that fundamental service to a city that really was going through a lot.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, I will say something. You know, obviously, you know, we're on the outside. The whole country was on hold. The whole world was on the outside. You know, watching, and you know, you kind of put it just now in the way where you kind of stripped it down, and made it real. You know, for us and for people. And I did see you speak recently after the governor. It was a couple of weeks ago. It might have been a month or so ago. And I will say, I'll give you props for this. You look like you, I'm not going to say you're weathered in any way, but you know, you took a step. You got a little, what's the word I want to say? Maybe a little tougher, a little thicker, a little more confident. I think it only comes with experience and age. There's nothing you can do. You know, you had no choice but to, like you said, you know, the race is going to start. You have to compete. You have to get in there. And one of the main things is your core belief. You know, you got to tell the truth. You know, you got to tell the truth and go by what you feel. You know, how did the media, you know, I'm not saying take a shot or I'm looking for positive, negative, but, you know, you have to is the media a very, very vibrant and tough force, even in, you know, a smaller city versus, you know, New York or LA or Chicago, you know, I mean, I'm sure it was coming out hard all over the place, especially with social media as well. What was that like? You were able to deal with it? Did you, you know, just look at some of the stuff and, or just keep it to the side? You kept it at bay. How did you handle that?
Well, I mean, the hardest part is when there's either misinformation out there that just quite simply isn't true. You know, I mean, I remember looking back to the unrest following George Floyd's murder. And, you know, it wasn't a matter of planning or preparation. It was just simple math. We did not have the numbers to be able to handle what we were experiencing. And that's one of the hardest things is, you know, as we were waiting on assistance from some other jurisdictions to come in, and, you know, the National Guard hadn't quite gotten there yet, and the State Patrol was not in town. The reality is we just did not have the personnel. Right. And there's nothing that you can say in those horrible moments that'll reassure people when you're in those very grave and difficult circumstances. And so, look, my foundational thing was just tell the truth, which I did.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
You know, but at the same time, you know, I'm the mayor and you're also responsible. Even if it's not all on you, given the circumstances were so unprecedented, it's also your responsibility to get the city through, regardless. And you are held accountable for the results. And I Absolutely. Get that. And I
yeah.
own that.
Yeah.
And I'll say, you know, you also learn a lot. And I mean, I feel like over this last year, I've grown as a mayor. I like to think that I've grown as a person. And you use those experiences going forward. And, you know, I've got a few more gray hairs and quite a few more crow's feet, but you know, those you know, battle wounds, if you will, hopefully can be used for good progress going forward.
100%. Absolutely. How's the city today? I mean, I know, you know, the last couple of weeks were with the verdict, and obviously there were just things popping at all times, but how's the city? How's the feel of the city, you know, today in 2021? I mean, pandemic is easing up quite a bit there, right? People are coming back out, and the restaurants are getting filled again. So how is the city today?
I mean, there are multiple truths associated with where the city is right now. I think it is coming back to life. I mean, restaurants are opening. People are giving each other hugs again, which they haven't done for a long time. There's this level of of interaction and love that's on the street that hasn't been there for quite some time, simply because people are able to interact again. And that in and of itself is a beautiful thing. Right. You know, and you know, now that we're moving past COVID gradually but surely, we're opening things up. I mean, you see a vibrancy on the street that hasn't been there in quite some time, and there's certainly a lot of demand for people to be with each other again. Now, simultaneously, we've got safety concerns. You know, we've got little kids that have gotten shot. We've got families that have forever been changed due to some of the gun violence that we're seeing in Minneapolis. And I know we're not unique. New York City is experiencing a pretty Absolutely. Major uptick in violence as well.
Correct.
Chicago, I mean, you name it, every city throughout the country is seeing these trends take place. And so it's both fulfilling and really heavy at the same time in the present state. And, you know, I think, you know, we all need to be able to understand and acknowledge these multiple truths at the same time. And whether that's the nature of Minneapolis as a city, an amazing place with extraordinary people that also has many shortcomings, or it's our present state. And so often right now, given the way like social media operates or the news even, you know, it's these sound bites and these headlines and these hashtags that don't paint the full picture necessarily and cause people to go into these camps where they're only dealing in absolutes, all bad, all good, you know? And it's never the truth. The truth is more difficult. The truth is more complex and far more gray.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's a good term actually, you know, a multiple truths. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's true.
It is. That's really, I kind of like that. That's great. If you could go on a run with one person from any point in history, who might it be? Or anybody that comes to your mind, with it doesn't have to be any point in history. Anybody, you know, anybody come to your mind? And good question, right?
Not bad. It is a good question. You know, well, since I'm on the call with you right now, and given that this is my perfect scenario where the individual could actually run, let alone walk, I'm going with Grandma Dell. Go with your mom. You know, I mean, she was always a person that was just chock full of wisdom. She told you like it is, you know, a tried and true New Yorker and a teacher, and you know, some of the best lessons that I've gotten in life were from Grandma Dell. Adele, wow. By the way, but you know, you shorten it when you're calling your grandma. I think it would be her, but you know, I never barely saw her walk to the mailbox, let alone go for a run. So I don't know.
Exactly. That's true.
She would take her car out to go to Temple, which was like four blocks away or something.
No doubt about it. No doubt. So for tourists coming to the Minneapolis, give us a shout out of a place, if you're allowed, what are some of the good spots to hit in Minneapolis that people are could look forward to? You got anything good? Are you allowed to say that?
Yeah, I mean, Cuzzy's is a classic, and you're wearing a classic shirt there right now, and I haven't been back there, but that is a Cuzzy's is definitely a classic. And you know, one where Sarah and I have been going a whole lot recently is FEMA's downtown. Really great joint is this. It's Sephardic Jew that runs the place. And so, you know, with Sephardic Judaism, it's like this weird combination of Moroccan and Jewish and French and whatever. But it's a really good vibe there. Good drinks, all the rest. Pimento, if you like good Jamaican food, and jerk chicken. Excellent. Cool. It's just a legendary spot right now. So I don't know. There's a few good ones. It depends what you're in the mood for. But, you know, I'll tell you, Louis, we also have got bagels too. Now, I mean, I don't know.
Come
that
on,
we're
stop,
at.
Stop.
I don't know if there's bagel oasis or anything.
You're drinking the Kool-Aid, right?
Yeah, right.
You are drinking the Kool-Aid, pal.
Yeah. Well, you know, ship some of the New York water out. And I know that's right. The claim as to why the bagels are so good there, but we got good water here. We have good water.
Yeah, hold on a second. Hold on. Yeah, don't worry. I'll edit that. Don't worry. Anyway, yeah. What are some of the main concerns that you see going forward running now on the next round?
Well, the decision to run again for re-election was a much longer conversation, certainly with Sarah, than it normally is. And it's
right.
And, you know, we make the decision together, given that it really is a joint effort and it impacts our whole family. And, you know, normally it's when you make a decision to run, it's you know, what's the big vision? What's the coalition you're going to build?
But
right now, it's feeling this very deep-seated responsibility to get the city through this. You know, I take that very seriously. I take that responsibility very seriously. And I mean, with respect to the election, look, it's looking good. You know, we're very strong right now. Locking up a series of endorsements from our attorney general, Keith Ellison, who actually handled the Derek Chauvin murder case, to AFSCME, just endorsed us yesterday. And that one particularly meant a lot to me just because these are, you know, the employees that we work with at City Hall. Right. To have their support means the world. You know, it's looking good. It's feeling good. And we've got, I think, a strong message that is based in honesty. You know, I think there are plenty of candidates out there that'll just say, hey, this, do this, say that, abolish this, change this, and then suddenly it's all good. That's just not the reality of these situations. And it doesn't outline the true complexities of actually being mayor. This is Absolutely. A tough job. And, you know, a big part of it is having the courage to stand your ground when you're getting hit from all different directions. It's having the conviction to stick with your principles, even when you're getting pounded on a little bit, you know, and in so many respects, being mayor is you're also dealing with all of these issues that nobody else wants to deal with. And so, you know, issues that don't want to be handled by the feds are passed down to the state. That don't want to be handled by the state. They're passed down to cities. And then we are the ones, mayors largely, that are trying to figure out how to deal with all these shortcomings of society.
Yeah, it all comes down to the local. It all comes down to the local. Absolutely.
All comes down, and it all comes to a head. And that's both what makes the job hard, but it's also what I love about it, because you get to dig into these very thorny, difficult issues.
Well, you know, that's a great way to tie it up, because you know, glad he could go circle back to the way you started running. You started putting both feet in, digging in, complete diligent. I mean, really, really, really dedicated. And I, you know, you come across as you really want to help. You want to help. Not only do you want to help and do the right thing and help everybody, but I think you actually, you know, besides caring, you believe you might be able to. This is a beautiful thing. You really do, or the way it's conveyed to me, and maybe to I'm hoping to everybody else out there, is that, you know, the message you're conveying is that, you know, you do really care. You can help. It's not just me, everybody. We have to be in this together. You need the team. You need the cooperation. You need people. There are multiple truths here. There are multiple falsehoods that come on the other side that need to be bridged. And that, in a nutshell, you know, I'm going to go back and say it. I mean, you are a mensch, you know, you really are. It's amazing. My nephew or not, you know?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, really. I mean,
I went from like a loser at the beginning of the podcast now to a mensch at the end, regardless. Yeah, you know, I'm, yeah, yeah. No, it's, well, you know, right. I don't know. I have to come back on the show more often, I guess, because you're giving me a little bit of juice back here, Uncle Louie.
I hope so. I hope so. I want to say thank you, brother, so, so, so much. I can't tell you how honored I am and appreciative that you actually took the time to, you know, speak candidly really. You know, again, what you, I know this, what you see is what you get. And that's what's so amazing about, you know, about you. You know, you're right. You gotta come across, you gotta talk a certain way. You have to promote, you have to be a certain personality, but this is really, this is you. This has always been you. And I only wish you and Sarah, Frida, and everybody that touches you, let them get touched by you. You touch them. And I'm hoping that, you know, Minneapolis will and the whole really the whole country will take a look and see, because, we've watched you for the last couple of years. And, you know, I love you, man. But it's really you really, really, really have done a tremendous, tremendous job. And I want to thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Uncle Louie. Love you. Love to the whole family as well.
Closing doors, please.